This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, the MTBE additive in gasoline means cleaner air, but more pollution in our drinking water. What to do? Transmission towers for cell phones. Can neighborhoods stop intrusions from these symptoms of a society that just can't stop talking? We visit the high plains of New Mexico, where Stephen Bodio looks beyond the ski resorts and dude ranches and finds the real West. And on the Earth calendar, puffins are hatching in their burrows on rocky islands off the Maine coast. These stories and more coming up on the Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. From Maine to Texas to California, state and federal officials, as well as environmentalists and others, are questioning the benefits of the gasoline additive MTBE. It has significantly reduced smog emissions from automobiles, and at the same time, it's making its way into drinking water. This has many wondering what effects it's having on humans, animals, and the environment. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has the story.
Charles Drevna is Director of Government and Regulatory Affairs with the Oxygenated Fuels Association, which represents the interests of petrochemical, oil, and technology companies. He describes why methyl tertiary butyl ether was originally added to gasoline.
MTBE is the major ingredient in cleaner burning, smog, and toxic reducing gasoline. It was designed, first of all, in the late 70s to replace lead, as this country did the right thing by taking lead out of gasoline.
In an effort to improve air quality, provisions in the 1990 Clean Air Act mandated producers to reformulate gasoline. MTBE became the preferred additive and has been widely used across the country.
The problem is that one of these oxygenates, MTBE, as it turns out, has a character that makes it more dangerous to groundwater. And that is that it migrates quickly through the soils, more quickly than other components of gasoline, and it doesn't evaporate into the air, that same character, so that it's more persistent.
Greg Whetstone is Director of Advocacy Programs for the nonprofit environmental group Natural Resources Defense Council. MTBE is showing up in groundwater supplies in Maine, California, and elsewhere, which leaves Whetstone and others wondering what effects this is having on humans and the environment as a whole.
The fact is MTBE has a very low odor threshold. You can detect it, you can smell it in water at very low levels, and it's really a marker for a broader problem. Other components of gasoline, say benzene, are much more potent carcinogens.
Among the institutions researching the potential health effects of MTBE is the University of California, Davis. Dan Chang, professor and chair of the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering, describes the findings of a UC Davis report.
There seems to be sufficient evidence that it has caused cancer in two types of laboratory animal strains, which under California regulations would be adequate to consider it to be carcinogen, to be carcinogenic. Now, again, these are at quite high levels in which the cancers occur. And so, there are many, many substances that will cause cancers at very high levels of introduction. So, but it is considered to be an animal carcinogen, and by presumption, the mechanisms, one of the conclusions that Dr. Foynes, who was the primary author for that particular section, is that there's no reason to believe that the mechanisms that would cause the animal cancers to appear could not occur in humans.
But the science showing MTBE to be a human carcinogen continues to be debated. The Oxygenated Fuels Association points to five other recently conducted studies showing MTBE not to be a human carcinogen. One thing experts do agree on is the way the fuel additive has been contaminating groundwater supplies. The main problem has been leaky underground gas tanks. As of December of last year, gas stations and others were required by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to replace outdated tanks. The EPA estimates that 30,000 leaks were occurring annually, and those are just the leaks that were reported to the federal agency. Even though many of the old tanks have been replaced, Dan Chang says faulty piping has also led to groundwater contamination with MTBE. This includes pipes that lead to underground tanks or lines coming from tanker trucks. He cites one example that occurred in Lake Tahoe, California, where some groundwater supplies have been contaminated with MTBE.
There was an operation and maintenance problem that when the fuel tank trucks were coming in, they were supposed to be an automatic shutoff valve, just like, you know, when you're filling your gas tank. And it wasn't functioning properly, and it would overflow, and then it actually overflowed the containment that was meant to catch small spills, but not, you know, if they aren't paying attention and it doesn't shut off automatically, they could have a larger spill.
A Blue Ribbon EPA panel has been reviewing the issues posed by the use of MTBE and other oxygenates in gasoline. Its recommendations are expected to be released in the beginning of July. Meanwhile, Dan Chang says MTBE has reduced smog emissions across the country, and he hopes state and federal officials will take a careful look at the scientific evidence surrounding MTBE, something that was addressed in the UC Davis report.
The report basically says, okay, if you take MTBE out of gasoline, you're going to put something back into it. I mean, it'll either be more of what was regular gasoline, but presumably to meet these air quality requirements and goals, it's going to be something else. And that something else may or may not be as well studied as MTBE. MTBE's toxicity, you know, in an acute sense, is quite low. And at the levels at which the public might have exposure, it's not, you know, again, my personal view, it's not a big health risk.
As the EPA analyzes the data on MTBE, some states are taking their own steps to protect the health of residents. California Governor Gray Davis is ordering the use of MTBE to be phased out by the year 2002, and Maine Governor Angus King wants his state to find alternative fuels that have the same smog-reducing properties as MTBE. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
It seems as though every time you look, someone is talking on a cellular phone, whether it be in a car, on a city street, during dinner at a restaurant, or wherever. Cell phones are changing the way we communicate. They're also changing our environment. Scientists continue to debate the health effects of cell tower radiation, but one problem that almost everyone agrees on is the problem of siting. Where do you put all the towers? I spoke with two people who have thought a lot about this issue. John Moeller is a cancer researcher at the Medical College of Wisconsin, and Libby Kelly is with the Council on Wireless Technology, a citizens group based in California. Libby, what has been your experience in this issue, and how should communities deal with it?
Well, I became involved with this because of an issue like that. There was a proposal to site a cell tower on the steeple of my church about 2.5 years ago, which was the first year of the Telecom Act went into play, and because of the knowledge I gained from that experience, I realized that the questions of citizens' rights to get involved in these local tower decisions had already been addressed by federal law, and the answer was, no, we really have very little to say about it. As a result, I joined with citizens across the country, and we filed a regulatory appeal requesting a review of the federal FCC rules governing the implementation under the Telecom Act. And we charged that there wasn't enough attention being paid to due process and citizens' rights for participation and right of free speech on this issue.
So the net result, though, is that communities do have zoning powers and so on to deal with this.
Some communities aren't using them. There are communities around this country which have absolutely given no thought to zoning of towers or antennas. Some places have got very good procedures in place. Some places have absolutely nothing.
So the place that has none, our listener who lives in a community that has none, what should they be doing?
They should be pressing their local zoning officials, whether they're elected or professionals, to develop reasonable zoning codes to cover towers and antennas in general. And there are ordinances out there. I think Libby in your area, San Diego, has something that other people are using as a model. But some places have absolutely nothing.
Yes, that's true. In our county, we have a telecommunications master plan. However, unfortunately, it's the participants in developing this have been highly influenced by industry. There has been a lot of litigation or threats of litigation brought by industry against towns who appear to be making decisions in favor of the concern for health effects or even property values.
So
I'm not saying it's easy. I'm just saying that good zoning is better than no zoning.
Right. So what should the citizen want to see in a local zoning provision or a local law to see that these considerations are dealt with and that their community doesn't look like a quill when they, by the time they get through with towers sticking up all over the place?
Well, I live in an environmentally concerned area, Marin County, so actually we're very proud here. Most of these towers are nicely hidden. But a member of the Planning Commission was quoted as saying, I have to know where they are so I can avoid them. The town of Lookout Mountain, Golden, Colorado, lives eyeball to eyeball at the same altitude with the antenna farm, and they not only are dismayed by the view, but they believe it's making them sick.
Well, they're also butt up against or maybe over the FCC standard, too. I mean, that's very, very powerful array.
Yes,
and
it is.
No resistance to a cell telephone tower. But some of the points she made about, yes, these can be concealed, although, frankly, there's no reason why people shouldn't be told where they are if they are concealed. Ordinance for have to have provisions for making sure people take down towers when they're out of service. Some people have neglected that, and there are unused towers dotting the country.
So I suppose one of the things that ought to be part of the statute is to make sure that reasonable alternatives have been excluded or have been considered before somebody goes up and puts up a new one.
There was just a Supreme Court decision 2 days ago in favor of Amherst, New Hampshire. On that point had taken them to court because they had failed to allow a siting, and the Supreme Court was in favor of the town, saying that OmniPoint should have come up with an alternative site, and they didn't as part of their proposal. That's a major decision.
Zoning can encourage co-location, multiple antennas in the same site, although, frankly, that can be rather ugly. That's not it's a mixed blessing.
Although I suppose you could put more than one antenna on the same pole, couldn't you, and thus reduce the spikes?
That can end up, that gives you less towers, but it can give you a pretty ugly tower. So that can be a mixed blessing. But, I mean, they can say you can't put up a new tower when there's an existing tower, or you can't put up a tower when it could be on a silo instead.
And one quick question. What are the chances that all of this technology becomes obsolete and we move everything to satellites before we finish this round?
Well, I'm not sure that is a solution. There already is some indication that the signal itself, whether it comes from satellite or cell phone or tower, is in the cumulative sense harmful.
I've been speaking with Lynn Kelly with a citizens group, Council on Wireless Technology, and John Mulder, a cancer researcher at the Medical College of Wisconsin. The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible collector car hobby. www.hemings.com. Contact us here. The Environment Show and share your views. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. By telephone, 1-888-49-GREEN. We'll be right back. This is Green Tips, tips on how you can save the world in your everyday life. You've heard on the Environment Show that our national parks are suffering from being left to death. Too many visitors and not enough money to maintain them. One way to take the pressure off the popular parks and have a vacation with more solitude is to visit some of the lesser-known sites in the 378-unit system. The National Park Service website is www.nps.gov. It lists the lesser-known parks, provides maps, and tells you what accommodations are available. Also, how to make reservations in all national parks. You can also get the list by calling 1-800-NAT-PARK, which is the number of the National Parks and Conservation Association. Next fall, when your friends talk of traffic jams in Yellowstone, you can describe hiking by 60-foot-high basalt columns at Devil's Post Pile National Monument in California, or tramping the battlefield in Pennsylvania, where a 22-year-old lieutenant colonel named George Washington in 1754 fought the first battle of the French and Indian War. Again, the National Park Service website is www.nps.gov. That's our green tip for this week. We all have places that are special to us. For some, it's a city street. For others, it's deep in the wilderness. For author Stephen Bodio, it's the high plateau of New Mexico, where Japanese industrialists are charged high prices to hunt big game. In this portrait of place, Bodio reads from his book, On the Edge of the Wild, Passions and Pleasures of a Naturalist.
Think of a dry plateau the size of Connecticut, maybe a little bigger, with an average height above sea level of, 7,000 feet. That's right, the flat ground is higher than Vermont's mountains. Brown plains, nappy and dry like a lion-colored pool table. Add the following, not just a few but many mountain chains, most north-south, one going more east-west, all reaching above 9 and some 10,000 feet, blue with pine and fir and spruce. Lots of snow in the winter, especially above 8,000 feet. Vertical weather. A day-night temperature difference of 40 degrees, winter and summer. People never made much impact here. Only 2,700 people live on the plateau today, most of them in towns where the only pavement is the road through. The size of western land and the distance you can see across it baffles by its apparent openness. East of the Mississippi, you can drive almost anywhere on paved roads and find signs of human occupation wherever you go. You bring these assumptions west as surely as the first European settlers brought theirs. One of the hardest preconceptions to throw off is that because you've seen the west from the interstate, you've seen the west. That 40-mile stretch between exits may be 40 miles without a single paved crossing. You may drive 100 miles at right angles to that exit before you hit another. What you've just defined by its edges is a block bigger than Rhode Island or Delaware with no pavement in it. This part of New Mexico is still the real West. It's a long way from Santa Fe and Taos, from tourists and New Age entrepreneurs and crystal miracles, from silver and turquoise everything and coyotes with bandanas and neo-Native American art. It's a long, dry drive to the nearest ski slope, Mercedes-Benz, or Arab horse. Most of its history is prehistory, the Pleistocene. The old ones, the Anasazi, a Navajo name, we don't know what they called themselves, were here for a good part of their cryptic history and left one famous ruin and hundreds of smaller ones, many still undisturbed. The Apaches followed. For a while, they're invincible in these, their woods and mountains. The miners flourished after the Apaches. They made a lot of holes and took away various things that were useful to them. Finally, there were the ranchers. They were good, tough men and women. But all the ranchers, old Spanish and new Anglo alike, were of European descent, and they did exactly what their ancestors had done. They fought what they thought was a necessary war against their competitors, animal and human. A few held on. Black bears, some black and shiny, others the color of Irish setters, adapt pretty well to humans, especially by their standards. They raid beehives and garbage cans and climb telephone poles when they get confused. They are wonderful animals, but they often seem more like pretty pigs or giant raccoons than real bears. The Plains tribes knew the difference. And there are cougars still. Deer are their fodder, and we still have plenty of deer. Besides, cougars are invisible. And, of course, coyotes are everywhere. They are smart and sophisticated, have a sense of humor, and know what to fear. They are so little threat to cattle that cowmen, as opposed to sheepmen, wool growers they call them now, treat coyotes with a mixture of affection and contempt. But the real competitors are gone or changed beyond recognition. The Apaches have achieved at least one victory. On their reservations, they now charge rich white men and Japanese industrialists the price of a small car to shoot carefully nurtured and pre-spotted bull elk, a ritual that these clients honestly think is hunting rather than the sort of decadent agriculture. The real bears, Plains Indian talk for grizzly, and the real wolves and the tigers, what the Mexicans call the jaguars, are just gone. Europeans never did get along with wolves and brown bears, for good reason. In our own dream time, bears competed with us for housing and meat, and wolves lived lives so much like ours that we made up stories of their exchanging shapes with us. When we began living in one place and keeping prey as our property, the war began in earnest. We brought it across the ocean with us, north across the big river, west across the plains.
That was author Stephen Bodio, reading from his book, On the Edge of the Wild, Passions and Pleasures of a Naturalist. It's published by the Lions Press. And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Right now, puffin chicks are hatching on the islands off the coast of Maine, from the mid part of the state north to Newfoundland. Dr. Steve Kress, Vice President for Bird Conservation of the National Audubon Society, says that chicks are hatching from eggs that were laid in underground burrows and rocky crevices.
When a baby puffin hatches, it stays underground in the nesting burrow for about 6 weeks. During that time, the chick is fuzzy. It is black with a white belly, a flattened beak that is black, and bright eyes.
Dr. Kress says a puffin chick eventually emerges from the burrow and heads out to sea.
They then stay at sea for the next several years, 2 or 3 years, and no one knows where they go at that point, but they are at sea, totally independent of their parents. They can drink salt water, they can capture food, they sleep on the sea, and usually they're offshore 100 miles or more from the mainland. Then when they are about 2 or 3 years old, they start coming back to the vicinity of the island where they hatched and start looking for a nesting place and a mate.
At maturity, puffins can chase small fish to depths of 200 feet using their wings as flippers. Dr. Kress describes these beautiful birds.
Puffins resemble penguins. They are upright birds. They walk. But they're not closely related to penguins, really. They just sort of look like them, but they're tiny. They're only about 10 inches tall. They have white bellies, white cheeks, and their most distinctive feature is their huge orange, blue, and yellow striped beak.
In the 1800s, humans hunted puffins off the coast of Maine for meat, and their feathers were used as pillow stuffing and hat decorations. By 1900, almost all of the puffins that once lived along Maine's coast were gone. An effort began in the 1970s to restore the puffins to Maine's coastal islands. It was called the Puffin Project. Dr. Kress is director of the project, and he played an important role in reintroducing puffins to their native habitat. Canadian puffin chicks were taken to the Maine islands, and at the same time, Dr. Kress used decoys as a means to attract more puffins.
Well, they'll land with the decoys, and they will sit with them. Sometimes they'll pick at them, particularly their belly and their beak, and then they'll settle down and rest with them. I think that they know that these decoys are not real, but they find comfort in sitting with them. And as they're sitting there, then other puffins land, and they find not just the wooden decoys, but they find other puffins resting with the decoys. So slowly we build up a critical mass of puffins. This is called The technique is called social attraction.
The Puffin Project has been a success, and Dr. Kress says populations are growing each year along Maine's coast. Also, techniques Kress has developed for puffin reintroduction are being used for other species in places like the Galapagos. So if you ever find yourself on the coast of Maine and see a puffin looking rather stiff, it could be a decoy. Or it may be a real puffin, mesmerized over a story it heard on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, a fight about trees in a little private park in New York City shows that chainsaw can cause neighbors to fight with neighbors in cities as well as in our great national forests. We talk green about construction waste, dead drywall, concrete, and lumber. Can it be recycled? Disposing of it can add to the cost of your new or renovated home, and we're running out of places to put it. And listeners comment on substitute crops for tobacco farms and the sale of trees at the Tongass National Forest. Stay with us. If a tree falls in the forest, does anybody hear it? Maybe or maybe not. But if a tree falls in Gramercy Park in New York City, there will be hell to pay. In a city like New York, green space is a precious commodity. And like anything precious and scarce, there's usually a fight over it. For 150 years, access to Gramercy Park, the city's only private park, has been the privilege of those who live in the neighborhood. While intended to provide sanctuary from the hectic city life, Gramercy Park in recent years has become a battleground over the protection of trees and animals that live there. Linda Anderson reports.
Protected by a tall, wrought iron fence, Gramercy Park is a 2-acre leafy green emerald, a jewel in the crown of one of Manhattan's most fashionable neighborhoods. Located at Lexington Avenue and 21st Street on the city's east side, Gramercy Park is available only to keyholders who reside in the buildings that are in the original trust. Modeled after London's private squares, the park was created in 1831 by developer Samuel Ruggles as Manhattan first expanded north of Wall Street. In the beginning, huge private houses went up, but eventually the 61 lots that surround the park became clubs, hotels, and exclusive co-ops. At a glance, the park appears to be a quiet respite. But in recent years, it has become a hotbed of debate. It all began on April 5th, 1994, a day that Alden James will tell you lives on in infamy.
A member came into the club and asked if I was aware that buzzsaws were going on in Gramercy Park. I said I was not, and I called a trustee of the park who lived here, Mr. Leitner, Stephen Leitner, a lawyer. He said he wasn't aware of any authorized wood cutting, tree care going on, and I took the club key and entered by the south gate.
Alden James is the president and resident of the National Art Club at 15 Gramercy Park.
And what I saw, I'll never forget. Trees were all over the ground. It was a horrible experience. Men were everywhere. They looked like they had a sense of urgency. And I went and I asked them what was going on, and they said the woman who runs the park had given the order.
The woman who runs the park is Sharon Benenson, who James colorfully describes as Annie Get Your Chainsaw. Actually, she's the chair for the trustees of Gramercy Park, appointed for life, as are all of the park's trustees. On that day, depending on who you talk to, 4 to 12 trees were cut down. James will tell you the job was done willy-nilly, a fait accompli, done before keyholders could protest. Benenson will tell you it was a decision the trustees made after consulting with a number of arborists.
When the arborist came into the park and evaluated the health of the trees, one of the things that they discussed with the greatest interest was the hazardous nature of some of the trees. A lot of the trees, especially the upper story trees that are in the park now, are either mature or what arborists describe as post-mature. There were trees there in 1994 which had very large holes and fissures in them, which the arborist described as particularly hazardous, and that was much more determinant of whether they should be left in the park than just their health. The woody plant policy of the park is to leave trees and shrubs, woody shrubs, growing for as long as they are healthy and productive, and not to remove them unless they're a threat of some kind.
But Alden James and other key holders who in their outrage formed the Gramercy Park Lot Owners Association don't believe her. In their mind, Benenson is not concerned about the trees, but rather attempting to redesign the park, pruning it to death, James says, to turn it into an Italianate garden. Far from the lush environment it once was, he thinks the park is beginning to look more like the landscaping around a Hyatt.
There was a big trees here. They've been cut down, these little trees. That's a chestnut. That survived. She's hacked away at the old English elm here. She said it was weak because it's hollow. But before you know it, it looks like a piece of asparagus now.
The Gramercy Park Lot Owners Association took the trustees to court over the tree matter and lost. That decision is being appealed. Alden James says some of the trees cut down in the park were over 100 years old, and regardless of the circumstances for their removal, Marcia Reese says it is a great loss. Reese, policy director for the Parks Council, a nonprofit organization that promotes public parks in New York City, points out that in a small park like Gramercy, the absence of the cut trees has a huge impact. It will take decades, she points out, to replace trees of that breadth and height. In an urban setting, Reese says trees contribute incalculable value in almost every category that is important to a city.
In terms of our environment and our health, they filter pollutants out of the air. They make the air cleaner for all of us to breathe. They obviously are very important to the life and sustenance of wildlife in the city, to birds and to small mammals. And we really have a very large wildlife population in this city. I think most people are aware that even coyotes have been found in Central Park, and there certainly are many, many birds and many small mammals. So that this is a city for more than just 7 million people. Economically, there are studies have been done that, in general, the more trees in a neighborhood, the more affluent that community is.
Reese says in a city, when people go to recreate or relax, they seek the company of trees. The uproar in Gramercy Park, she believes, is testimony to just how important trees are to people, a belief echoed by Gramercy Park resident Dr. Joni Watkins.
It's when you walk into this park, it's not only the trees, but it's the love that's been given to the trees over the years and to this environment, that there's a special feeling. You can feel the difference the minute you get inside the park. It's a sanctuary.
However, these days, amid all the strife, the park appears to offer less sanctuary than it used to. Alden James, who thinks of Gramercy Park as a front yard shared by all keyholders, laments over the state of the park. He says it's easier to replace a highboy than a 100-year-old tree. Benenson, too, laments, saying old trees, like old friends, die. Gramercy Park is just one small park in the densest city in the nation. Yet the issues faced here are the very same issues being fought between environmentalists and loggers out west. The ongoing issues faced in Gramercy Park are a microcosm of how scarce resources are bound to be fought over tooth and nail, even among a wealthy, homogeneous community of people. And far from settling down, finger-pointing and accusations are happening again over Gramercy Park, this time over the use of avitrol, a pesticide being used to control the park's pigeon population. For the Environment Show, I'm Linda Anderson.
You don't see any blue jays here. There used to be blue jays. The poison is just, you hardly see any birds. one Togan pigeon here. There used to be large flocks. And she used to say, you know, that they created, you know, they're quite a health hazard.
We're talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. Garbage and getting rid of it or recycling it preoccupies mayors, environmentalists, homeowners, land use planners, just about everybody who's concerned about waste and its disposal. But when we think about waste, we normally think about the stuff we put in plastic bags in our kitchen or in our recycling bins. And indeed, in 1997, we generated about 209 million tons of municipal solid waste. But at the same time, also generated was 136 million tons, or two-thirds as much, of construction waste. And this is the dead drywall, the old lumber, asphalt, concrete, everything that's left over when we either build something or demolish something. And many municipalities don't allow this kind of material in their municipal landfills, and so what happens to it has always been a problem. So we're going to be talking about construction waste and its disposal, and you might be thinking about what's happening in your neighborhood as a result of it. My guests are Timothy Townsend. He's Assistant Professor of Environmental Engineering Sciences at the University of Florida in Gainesville, who has been doing research on this activity for the state of Florida. Peter Yost, who is Director of Resource and Environmental Analysis for the National Association of Home Builders Research Center. That's an independent organization based in Maryland. And Nevin Cohen, who is Director of Research at INFORM, which is a national nonprofit organization that works on environmental policy issues. To begin, Timothy Townsend from Florida, in order to get this thing straight in our heads, what really is construction waste? What are we talking about here?
Well, a lot of times you hear the term construction and demolition waste, and really you're talking about solid waste produced during the construction, renovation, or demolition of man-made structures, from houses to commercial buildings, even including roadways and bridges.
So this is just about everything except your coffee grounds.
Just about.
And Peter Yost from the Home Builders, is getting rid of this stuff a problem for the home builder, and is it expensive? Does it add a lot to the costs of houses when you build them?
Well, the importance of this issue to builders kind of jumps around quite a bit. But yes, this is a growing concern for builders as they have a harder time finding places to take care of the waste generated during construction or renovation projects. So this is pretty high on their radar screen.
Nevin Cohen from INFORM, what do we know about where construction waste goes today?
Well, it goes to our municipal landfills, but I'm located in New York City, where our last landfill is scheduled to be closed in 2001. Listeners may have heard that we're having a hard time finding other landfills that will accept our waste, and construction and demolition waste is by volume a huge amount, and it's very difficult to find places to throw it away. That's why waste prevention is an important step.
Well, that's a question that so immediately comes to mind. Why don't we recycle a lot of this stuff?
Well, some material is ripe for recycling, but there are actually steps we can take before we even generate the construction and demolition waste, and that ranges from taking care of the buildings that we have, making sure we don't need to build new buildings before we do that, if we can reuse our existing buildings, and then designing our new buildings so that they can be literally taken apart and the materials in the building reused.
Timothy Townsend, what's happening in Florida, where you've got all this construction that seems to be going on all the time?
Yeah, absolutely. We're a rapidly growing state here, and right now I'd probably say that most, or about maybe half or so, is going into landfills, and the rest of it is being processed at so-called recycling facilities. The difficulty for getting recycling to really pick up to speed here in Florida, two things. Number one, economics. It's still cheaper in most areas of the state to put it in a landfill. With new regulations requiring groundwater monitoring at these sites, it's anticipated that it's going to get more economically feasible to recycle. And then number two, finding the markets for the materials. That's been something that we've struggled with and are continuing to work on here in the state.
All of you have mentioned the fact that it's going into landfills. Do we think of this material as presenting the same kind of threat to groundwater and the environment generally as we do other kinds of garbage?
I'd say that no, you wouldn't be the same kind of threat, but is there an impact on the environment? And the answer is definitely yes. Even some of the basic materials in an everyday home, when put into the ground, can have an impact on groundwater, from sulfate leaching from gypsum drywall into the groundwater, or even from that same sulfate turning into hydrogen sulfide gas and causing odor problems at a landfill site. So even some of the things which aren't necessarily typical hazardous chemicals can still have an impact on the environment, and thus the need to recycle that is still present.
Plus, there's energy that goes into making the materials in the first place, and there's energy to transport the waste to a landfill. So to the extent we can recycle, reuse, and prevent waste, we're saving lots of energy.
You've talked about the fact that this normally doesn't present the same problems that hazardous chemicals do. But when I was commissioner of environmental conservation in the state of New York now 20 years ago, one of the things that we found was that toxic waste, the stuff that people had been stashing away in barrels in places that it shouldn't have been, often got dumped on the top of the construction waste as a means of getting rid of it, and then got dumped in the landfill. So the construction waste basically was flavored and salted with illegal chemical waste because they didn't know what else to do or didn't want to do something else with the chemical waste. Is that still a problem around the country?
Well, it's an interesting question that EPA has addressed. You know, they were sued by the Sierra Club a couple years ago because construction waste comes underneath the definition of conditionally exempt small quantity generation. And their response, to make a long story short, was to require that new landfills, C&D landfills, and existing ones develop a monitoring plan, because for most states, and C&D waste is regulated at the state level, they have regulations on C&D landfills that are relatively less strict than municipal solid waste landfills, but they are imposing a groundwater monitoring requirement so that they can start to get data on exactly what level of hazard these landfills do pose. Because to date, we just don't have that much information on leachate from C&D-type landfills.
And what do we know, and let me ask all three of you, of how much of this stuff really does wind up in municipal landfills and how much winds up in private places elsewhere because municipalities won't take it? Timothy Townsend, what's the practice in Florida?
In Florida, I would say that most of the I'd say maybe 60-70% of the C&D waste is ending up in a private C&D facility. The rest is either going to a county-owned, what's known as a Class 3 or C&D facility, or possibly a municipal landfill, but most of it's going to a private facility.
And Peter Yost, representing home builders, what do most of your members do with the stuff that they generate as they build houses?
I'd have to agree with Timothy. The relationship between tipping fees at MSW landfills and compared to the C&D or Class 3 landfills makes it such that most of the waste goes to private C&D landfills. However, the builder never makes that decision. If he's hiring a hauling company, the driver with the dispatcher works out the costs of the economics of driving as compared to the tipping fee, and then they decide which landfill it goes to. But the differential between tipping fees for C&D and MSW in this area can be as much as $30 a ton differential. So that's often what drives which type of landfill it ends up in.
And then this raises another issue, which is maybe not totally environmental, but certainly has to do with public policy. Maybe you can shed some light on this, Nevin from New York. This is an area in which the mob has played a role over time. You certainly read about indictments and convictions over the years. To what extent is this whole game still governed to some extent by organized crime?
I can't comment on that directly, but and we have made a great deal of progress in New York City in cleaning up our garbage industry. But the real driver is economics, and the point that Peter made is very important, that if someone else is responsible for disposing of the waste, other than the person who is generating it, there's a disconnect, and that doesn't allow for incentives to cut down on the amount of waste that's generated. It's pretty important, too, to realize that without flow control, you know, that was the big court case that went to the Supreme Court saying that, you know, trash is basically a commodity of commerce and states can't regulate where it goes. Well, that means that New York State may have expensive landfills, but if we have cheap ones down here in Maryland, they can truck it down here and it's part of commerce. So that makes a big difference. It makes it difficult for cities to project their waste needs when materials can flow so easily from areas of the country with high tipping fees to areas of the country with low tipping fees.
We recently published a guidance manual for New York City government to use in its own construction and maintenance activities, ways to reduce the generation of this kind of waste. And these findings that we came up with have been integrated into new building guidelines that the city is developing for its projects. So there are positive things that municipalities and states can do to cut down on the amount of waste they generate.
We're trying to get builders to see this as a management issue, that waste is something that currently they don't include as part of their management plan. But if you think of construction waste management as simply another element of quality, then what goes into your dumpster is a reflection of the quality on your job site. So we're trying to get builders to really focus on using the trash stream as an indication of how money and materials are flowing on their job sites. And the better builders are taking a look at trash as a proxy for how quality is done by their subcontractors and by others on the job site. So there's some real encouraging trends in terms of alternatives to disposal.
Well, like a lot of pollution problems, the stuff that's left over is waste, and if you have less of it, presumably you can be more profitable. Are there things that you can do in Florida, Timothy, with respect to the way people build things that could reduce the amount of waste that occurs during the process?
Yeah, well, definitely. And I think, you know, I'd have to reflect to some of the work that Peter and the Home Builders Association has done in terms of guidance on how to actually work with subcontractors and how to design and how to construct. And those are the types of things that the Home Builders Associations here in Florida are starting to try and look into and get information on.
But aren't we all subsidizing the construction industry to the extent that they're using municipal and public facilities that we all pay for to do their own projects? Wouldn't it make sense to charge them more so that the total cost of construction also involves the cost of getting rid of whatever is left over?
I would say that that's more and more being done. As we see landfills close, we see tipping fees go up. And if illegal disposal becomes an issue, which is generally what tends to happen, if there's cheap disposal, you tend to have very little illegal dumping of C&D waste. But as cheap landfills close and the costs go up, and illegal dumping is a social cost. So, for example, in Hawaii, they're having tremendous C&D waste disposal problems, particularly related to illegal disposal in very, you know, pristine areas that are valuable for tourism. So I think, you see, as the social costs go up, there is a greater constraint put on the building industry to better reflect the costs of disposal.
So very quickly from each of you, thinking in terms of the environment, is it better to charge the generator of waste more to get rid of it and thereby reduce some of the waste that way, or is it better to have it cheap so that it doesn't wind up being dumped illegally? Let's just go down the list. Timothy, what do you think?
Well, I think right now in Florida, the way it's moving is that landfill tip fees are going up, and it's just going to be a requirement to manage safe waste, and you're just going to have the proper enforcement and policing and education so you don't get illegal dumping.
Peter, what do you think? Higher costs or more enforcement or both?
I think it has to be a combination. I don't think there have to be higher costs, but I think there are going to be higher costs. And as you go along with that, there has to be some builder education. And also, we have to develop policies for taking care of illegal disposal.
And Nevin, from a New York perspective, where do we go on this one?
The cost of disposal has to reflect the total costs, including environmental costs. But government also has a responsibility to educate builders so that they can reduce their costs and reduce the waste they generate.
I want to thank our guests. They've been Timothy Towson from the University of Florida in Gainesville, Peter Yost from the National Home Builders Association, and Nevin Cohen from Inform, a nonprofit policy group that works on the environment. You may have questions or comments or waste that you want to get rid of. Call us. We'll send one of our panelists right over to pick it up. But more seriously, share your thoughts with us. Give us a call. Our number is 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Peter Burley. You can reach us here at The Environment Show by writing to us. It's The Environment Show, 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Email is green@wamc.org. It's time now to hear what some of our listeners are saying. Here's Stephen Westcott.
Some listeners responded to a recent discussion about tobacco farming. With fewer people smoking, there is a decline in the amount of tobacco being used. The tobacco growers' representative said that some farmers may find it difficult to grow other crops because of the small fields and terrain where tobacco is grown. But this listener has a suggestion.
A crop which could, at least temporarily, very easily be grown in the kind of habitat that was described, which would be very useful to have around, is chicory, C-H-I-C-O-R-Y, which is very useful as a salad green, as a cooked green as in spinach, and as a root substitute for coffee.
Another listener responded to a Talking Green discussion that aired some weeks back, focusing on timber harvests in Alaska's Tongass National Forest. She contacted us by email to say, quote, "I think the government should stop subsidizing the wood industry by practically giving away our trees. I don't want my tax money used to exploit our natural resources. It makes me ill that this goes on," end quote. We appreciate all comments, questions, and suggestions. You can reach our comment line by dialing 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
Hello, operator, I want you to be mine. Please deposit all your love and put me on the line. I'm listed under lonely, lost and feeling small.
Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. Puffins grow up we know not where while floating on the ocean. They don't worry about MTBE in their drinking water, cell phone towers on the horizon. What do they think about up there? Order a copy of this show, number 492, by calling 1-800-323-9262, and you'll find out that we don't know either. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer, Stephen Westcott is producer, and Ray Grant is post-production engineer. It's made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth, and join us next week for The Environment Show.